Perek Hey Tet says as follows. We're just going to do the beginning of the pasuk, really. Ohev Kesef Lo Yisba Kesef. This is a famous statement. He says the following: someone who loves money will not be satisfied with money, and someone who loves a bounty of things won't even have wheat, won't even have one of the most basic things. Gamze havel, this is all, again, this is all vanity. So the idea of loving money is very much put down in this particular verse. In other words, money can be used for many wonderful things. Of course, it can be used for building communities. It can be used for helping institutions in need. It can be used for mitzvah purposes. But you shouldn't love the money. You should love the fact that by getting money, you can help others. You can do things with the money. It shouldn't be that you're in love with money. That's a sickness, to be in love with money. So that's what we're being told here in this particular pasuk. It's a very famous verse. You ever heard it? One who loves money will not be satisfied with money. He'll always want more. He's never satisfied. He thinks that's going to fill him up. That's going to give him his joy, the fact that he has money. That's not going to do it. That's not going to fill a person's heart. That's not going to fill a person's mind. It's using the money for a meaningful purpose. That'll do it. But not just having the money per se.
There is that idiom, the more you have, the more you want.
There you go. Right. And by the way, it's such a true thing. You know, sometimes you think if you love money and you have it, it'll be enough for you. It won't be enough. Bernard Madoff is the biggest proof for that, and others like him, who you could have a nice lifestyle, everything, you pretty call it quits or whatever. No, you have to have more, and then you have to go into schemes, and you have to... It's incredible. Now, there's a statement from Rashi on this particular verse. He says, "An ohev mitzvot lo yisba mehem." And he adds, by the way, someone who loves not money, but someone who loves mitzvahs, so they will not be satisfied with the mitzvahs they do. They will want to do more and more mitzvahs, which is a good thing. Okay? They want to do more and more mitzvahs. So he gives an example in the Torah Tamima from Masechet Makot. He says, Zeh Moshe Rabbeinu. Who is this person who loves to do mitzvahs so much that we're talking about? An example is Moshe Rabbeinu. Shaya Yodea She'ein Shalosh Arim Shebe'evar Yardain Koltot Ad Shelo Nivcharu Shalosh Ve'eretz Kenan V'yamar Mitzvah Sheba'al Yadi Aikaimena. There's a famous thing that takes place in the Torah, where there are six Ari Miklat, three refuge cities that are set up for people to run to if they kill someone by accident. According to Jewish law, if you kill someone by accident, so the law is you're a murderer. You killed someone by accident, you're still a murderer. You don't get the death penalty, but there's a very severe penalty. You go into exile. You have to go to a city of refuge, and if you go out of that city, the relatives and, in fact, others as well can kill you if you leave that city to which you are exiled. Like, that's your prison, but it's a city that's your prison. Alright? So if you go to that city, so that city protects you, you have to go there if you killed somebody by accident. However, the law was that when Moshe was told these rules, he was said that he was told there were three cities he's supposed to set up that were here, right? And three others were going to be when they crossed over the Jordan, all right? But Moshe wasn't crossing over the Jordan. And the law was that the refuge cities in general are not going to be made operative until all six cities had been set up. So when Moses was told, okay, there are going to be three cities here and three later, he might have said, okay, well, I'm not going to deal with the three cities here because they're not going to even be operative until all six are set up and working. So why should I even try to do anything yet? But no, he loved mitzvot. So whatever you can do, you can do. Even if you try to, I'm going to appoint these three cities now, but they won't work yet. What are you doing it for? Because I love mitzvahs. I will do whatever I can in order to help facilitate mitzvah fulfillment. Even if I'm not the one who's going to be able to complete the task, still I'm going to get it started. A very critical idea that hachana, preparation for doing a mitzvah, should never scare someone away if they say, well, I'm not going to be around later. There's a famous Gemara, Masechet Tanit, it's a Choni Amagal, the famous individual who they called him Choni the Circle Maker, because he was so close to God, as it were, that when it would rain, so he would stand in a circle if there was like a drought, and he'd say to God, I want it to rain. And so it'd start drizzling. And he said, not drizzle, real rain. Right? I'm not leaving from this circle until you do it right. And then God would make a thunderstorm. He'd say, not a thunderstorm. Did I ask for a thunderstorm? A flood? Nice rain. Not a drizzle, not a thunderstorm. Just right. Goldilocks. You know, just right. Okay? And then God does it. So the Gemara says, they said to Choni Magal, you know what? You should excommunicate you for what you did. You know, but what can we do? God listens to you. You ask for it. You say, I'm not going to leave the circle. What a chutzpah. And then he listens to you. It's like a child asking from his father, and the father gives in. This is Choni Magal. Choni Magal is the one who went to sleep, and he sleep was like the Rip Van Winkle. He slept for like 40 years, or whatever. He slept for all these years. And before he went to sleep, he saw someone planting an olive tree. And he said, what are you planting an olive tree? It takes decades for that to grow. What are you doing it for? So the guy said, because someone planted for me, so I would have an olive tree, so I'm planting for my grandchildren. So he said, so he went to sleep and he woke up and he saw this guy with the olive tree, and he found out that guy was the grandchild of this guy who had planted the olive tree. This was, the Federation once called me for a statement that they could use some years ago, and I gave them the statement. They used it. They said, just like others have planted for me, so do I plant for those who come after me. So even though you can't be there sometimes even to see it, so you plant for others. So you give to the school. So you're getting old. You're not going to see the benefits or building the new building or whatever it is. Who cares? You're not going to see it. So you're helping out. You're creating the whole foundation. Do you know that the Beis HaMikdash, who built the Beis HaMikdash? King Solomon. Right? But it's called also the Beit David. It's called Beit David. When we say on Sukkot, Harachaman hu yakim lanu, it's Sukkot David hanofalet. May God raise up again, we say the Sukkah, the fallen Sukkah of King David, which refers to, some say, the temple. What do you mean it's King David? He didn't build it. King Solomon built it. No, but he collected all the money for it. He had everything ready to go, but God said you couldn't do it since you killed people. Your hands had blood on them, so you can't build the temple. The temple's purpose is for peace. You can't build the temple. Even though he served God by doing mitzvahs with the blood on his hands. But still, he could not build the temple. But he didn't say, okay, then I'm not, why should I even help out then? Why should I help out? No. Hachana is critical. Hasidim put great emphasis on hachana, on preparation for doing the mitzvah. The idea of doing with kavana, like this caused all the problem with the Hasidim and the Minagdim in the 17th, 18th centuries, because the Hasidim said, you have to prepare before you daven. Okay? The Gemara also says you have to prepare for daven. The Gemara says that before they daven, the Hasidim HaRishonim, the early authorities, would sit for an hour before they daven and like meditate to get in the mood. You don't just like walk in and say, okay, I'm going to put on my tassels, fill in, let's go. You know, they come in, they calm down, they think about what I want to say today, they maybe learn a little ahead of time, right? Then they daven for an hour, then they relax an hour afterwards. Okay? They properly attune themselves to what they're going to be doing. All right, so it says the Hasidim would do this. So sometimes they would do it, and they would push off the time of davening. Like if you have to say Shema, which you do by 3 hours in the morning. Let's say you have to say Shema by now, by 10 o'clock in the morning. So they would go overtime, or davening. Let's say by 11. So they would go overtime, and they would miss the time of davening. And people say, what are you doing? The Bilagon would say to them, what are you doing? You're missing the whole mitzvah. And they said, and you guys are doing the mitzvah without any kavanah, without any preparation. So they thought the hachana was like more important, to make sure you prepare properly. And if you miss it, then you weren't ready. Okay, so you weren't ready anyway to talk to Hashem. But instead, you're going to talk to Hashem and not be ready? Can't do that. So their view was that the preparation was critical. The proof they bring for this, by the way, is from the mitzvah of sukkah. When you build the sukkah, okay, what is the most important part of the sukkah? What's the most important part? The roof. The schach. It's called the sukkah. Schach. Okay? Yeah, but how long does it take to put the schach on? It takes a few minutes. You just roll it through. You have the mat. Done. Finished. The hard part is putting up the walls. Okay? So thereby, you see the hachana, the preparation, is the hard part. And so too in all mitzvahs. It's the preparation for the mitzvah. That's where you really have to focus. And then, if you do that right, then everything else will fall into place. So the emphasis on hachana, on preparation, we are seeing here as well, that even if you can't totally give all the money or give all, your all to it, still the preparation for what is to come is very critical. No one should ever underestimate what you can do by laying the foundations of what's going to come. You know, my wife and I, because this is very dear to us, you know, we weren't raised observant. Okay, we were raised observant, and we always looked forward to having kids who would be observant when we became observant, right? And then they would have kids who are observant. And, you know, here we're laying the foundation here. So Moshe Rabbeinu, as well, he was the one, if you recall, about loving mitzvahs versus loving money. When they were going to go out of Egypt in Parshat Bo, so Moshe said, please, right, tell them to go ask from the Egyptians for their silver and gold. Ask them for their silver and gold. And they all went to run for the silver and gold. Now, what did Moshe run for? Anyone recall? What did Moshe run for? Moshe ran to get the bones of Yosef, who are going to be buried in Israel. Everyone else is running after the money. They were told to run after the money. They had a right to have to go out with silver and gold that they were, you know, taken into slavery by the Egyptians for hundreds of years. But Moshe said, you know, something more important. You're doing this mitzvah, even though that was also a mitzvah, but they're different kind of mitzvahs. So this mitzvah of going to get the bones of Yosef, he ran after that. All right? So there are mitzvahs and there are mitzvahs. And again, his primary focus was always on doing the right mitzvah, not necessarily on the money. You know, even it was a mitzvah to have money in this case. Oh, very good, Mr. Schreiber. It is true. Mr. Schreiber says there's a statement in Pirkei Avos that says you should always try to do an easy mitzvah or a hard mitzvah, so to speak, because you don't know the reward for mitzvahs. You don't know which one is easy and you know which one's hard. You don't really know. It looks easy. It looks easy. This is an easy mitzvah, but it could be, in God's understanding, a very difficult mitzvah to fulfill. So, correct. Good point. We are now moving on to chapter 7, verse 1. The verse says as follows. It says, Tov Shem Mishemen Tov. A good name is better than good oil. V'yom Hamavet, and the day of death, this is where it gets a little controversial, Miyom Hivaldo, is better than the day of birth. Wow. Then, and we'll go back, Tov alechet el beit avel, it's better to go to a house of mourning, milechet el beit mishteh, than going to a house of celebration, like a wedding. What would you do if you had a choice? A mourner's house or a wedding? I mean, what's better? You know you have to go to a mourner's house, but is it better? Is it, you want to do that? Basher hu sof kol ha'adam, since that's the end of man. When you go to a house of mourning, you recognize the end of man. V'achai yitein elibo, and you will put life on your mind when you go to such a house. Now, we're going to discuss this whole thing. Let's start from the beginning. First it says, a good name is better than good oil. So, various comments on this. First, in the Shirat David, just a very interesting comment for those of us who just had grandchildren born, or if you've had children born. He says, simply put, Beikar Perush, the main explanation of this, Yeshef Aresha Kavanah, means Shetov Hashem Shenotnim LeYeled. It's better the name you give to a newborn child. Yoter Mishemen Tov Shesachino Tovo. Better than the oil, like baby oil. In other words, the oil that you put on the baby is the name that you give to the baby. Is that beautiful? It's the name you give to the baby. Because the baby oil, okay, look, isn't his skin nice? Look, isn't he beautiful? Mazel Tov, okay? But the name, and we know certainly in Ashkenazic circles especially, where we name a person either after someone in the Parsha, right? Obviously not a wicked person. You're not going to name someone after a wicked person. You don't name someone Esav. You name him after a good person, and he will have the merits of that person. Or after a person has passed away, and you hope that child has the merits of that person, that is a much more significant thing, that name that will surround that child his entire life, than the good oil, the good things you're going to give the baby. All right, you're going to give the child. The way you're going to spoil the child, much better give him a good name that he'll be able to live up to, and you can tell him about this relative he had and so on, and why he was named that, and that's much better than any good oil that the baby's going to experience. And then there's some other comments in Vayizra Yitzchak, one of the books we've been using. The idea of a good name. The Medrash says something before that. The Medrash says as follows. It says, Shemen Tov Yered. Good oil, kind of you put it on and it goes down. A good name goes up. Goes up. Shemen Tov L'Shato. Good oil, it's temporary. You know, it loses its smell after a while, or its workability. as opposed to a Shem Tov, a good name, it's forever. Shemen Tov, Kila. Again, good oil disintegrates eventually, whereas out. Shem Tov, Eino Kila, it's never destroyed. Shemen Tov, Nikne Bedamim. Good oil, costs money. Shem Tov, Bechinam. A good name, it's free. It's free. You don't have to pay for it. You have to do what you have to do, but you don't have to pay for it. It doesn't cost you anything. Shem Tov, Bashirim. Uva'aniyim. A good name with wealthy people and poor people. You can have a good name. Shemen Tov, really good oil. Only wealthy people can afford it, it says. Shem Tov, Holech, Misof, Olam, Yad Sofo. A good name can go from one end of the world to the other end of the world. Good oil, one room to the other. You know, it smells nice and then it gets lost. So again, all these things, and the final thing it says that when a person dies, if you put oil on that person, like some have a custom to do on a person who dies, so the oil eventually rots with the person. But a good name, the person rots, you know, he dies, but the name lives on and doesn't rot. All these things show the greatness of having a good name. And in fact, he also brings here from the Muslim Gemara in Brachot Daf Yud Zayin, it says, very fascinating statement. Rabbi Yochanan says he was reading the book of Iyov, which we have learned in this class the years past. He was reading the book of Job, very heavy book. And he said, after he read it, Rabbi Yochanan said, Sof Adam Lamut, the end of man is that he dies. Vesof Behema L'Shchita, and an animal gets slaughtered. I mean, like, what's the difference? Both die. Hakol L'Mita Hemomdim, everyone's up now, but they're all going to be dead. Ashrei mi shigadal b'Torah. Happy is he, therefore, who is raised within a Torah atmosphere, va'amalo b'Torah, and engaged in Torah, v'yoseh nachat ruach liyotzro, and he does things that make, he brings nachas, pleasure to his Creator, to God. V'gadal b'shem tov, and he was raised with a good name. V'niftar b'shem tov, and he died with a good name. So that is the goal that we have, and that's what Shlomo HaMelech means. It's fun to say here when it says that a good name is better than good oil, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. He says what it means in with reference to a good name. The day of death is better than the day of birth. Obviously, it's better than the day of birth. It's better than why we celebrate that on a baby being born, and we mourn when a person dies. But in terms of the good name, when a child's given a name at birth, you don't know anything. He just has a name. You don't know what it means yet. But at a person's death, you recognize what that person did with that name, how significant it is, and therefore that's why it's emphasized here as it is. Yeah.
Where did I read that it says a good name goes above all?
Hold on to that. In Pirkei Avos. We'll get to that in 1 second. Good. Hold on.
Crown of a good name.
Yes. Okay, good. You forced me to go to it. All right. Okay, here we go. It says in Pirkei Avos, in the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalet, Mishnah Gimel, Rabbi Shimon Omer. Now listen and ask me a question. Ask me a question on this. Rabbi Shimon says, there are three crowns. Gimel Ketarim, there are three crowns. Ask me a question, ready? Keter Torah, the crown of Torah. Keter Kahuna, the crown of the priesthood. The Keter Malchut, and the crown of kingship. The Keter Shem Tov, but the crown of a good name, Oleh Al Gabehem. It rises over all of them. Listen to the language. There are three crowns. The crown of a good name.
Well, that's four crowns.
That's four crowns. What do you mean? Does it say there are four crowns, and this is the most important one? Why does it say there are three crowns, but the crown of a good name, then there are four crowns? What's going on? So the Al-Sheikh asked this question, one of the great Kabbalists, and the answer that is given is as follows. This is said by the Yitzhak Yitzchak in his work. He says that without a Shem Tov, without a good name, the other crowns are not crowns. And that's why it says that this crown is above all the other ones. It means to have those crowns have any meaning, you must already have the crown of a good name above them. And it's really not a fourth crown. It's one that goes with the other ones. Without them, the other three are meaningless. How can you have someone that say, he's a great Torah scholar, but he's a real bum? Well, so then, don't tell me he's a Torah scholar. It's not true. Okay, to be a Torah scholar, you have to appreciate what you learn, make it a part of your life, live what you're learning. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik used to say, it says, Tzadik be'emunato yichyeh. A righteous person okay, lives by his faith. Lives by his faith. Some people would emphasize, tzaddik bemunato yichya. A tzaddik lives by his faith. He had a faith. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said it's the wrong accent. It's tzaddik bemunato yichya. He says, a tzaddik by his faith lives. You have to live by your faith. It's not the faith that's being emphasized. You have to be one who lives by your faith. Otherwise, you're nothing. You're not a tzaddik. You have to live by your faith. So the idea here is to have a name of Torah or priesthood or of kingship. Without the good name, if you don't have the crown of the good name that's attached with each of those, then those others are not crowns at all. Then it's nothing. There are three crowns, but within each one of those crowns is the Shem Tov. Otherwise the whole thing falls. So a very critical idea. That's how he understands your question. And you see, though, it says the good name therefore has to go with everything. Everyone has to. You have to have a good name with everything else that you do. Don't think you've accomplished anything if you don't have this. He says the kulan lav klumhu. It's nothing if you do not have a good name.
And everybody can have a good name, but everybody can't be a Torah
scholar. Right.
Everybody can't be.
Right. And everyone can't be a king. Only the Davidic dynasty. Everyone can't be a king either. But a good name, everyone can have. You know. And so many times, I must say, and I have to tell you, people make the smallest mistake, and they lose their good name forever. You know, you not that people don't make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. Sometimes, you know, people don't realize, oh, he did this, he did that. No one's perfect. But to do something corrupt, the crown of good name excels them all. Okay, that's the source that you were referring to. All right. There are other items here as well to be mentioned. Now, this idea of birth and death, let me read you this. We said the day of death, right, is better than the day of birth. Wow.
Could that have to do with someone's accomplishments?
Okay, hold on. My taima. The Gemara says, what's the reason for that? Lefi kishinolad adam. First of all, when a person's born, monin lo lemita. Immediately, like, how do I say this? They start, you know, looking when he's going to die. You know, a guy only lives so many years, no matter who you are. You're born on this day, you know, one day you're going to die. You're put into a finite process starts. It's interesting to say the process starts, because I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I mentioned it in some class. When I was in, 10th grade, I remember just then they were discussing the notion of, it was just starting, heroic measures, you know, a person can live on a machine, and it was just starting. This would be in 1975 or 74 or something. And extending death and so on, and when does life end, and ideas like that. And so I remember we had a textbook that began with the following. Oh, it was so frightening. It said, when does death begin? Answer, at birth. Death begins at birth. What a terrible way to look at life. Death begins at birth. The process of death. The minute you start and you're born, you begin to die.
Right.
You begin to die. So here, when I saw this in the Gemara, it says, why is it the day of birth is better than the day of death is better than the day of birth? Because when you're born, moni lola mita, already like they start looking when you're going to die. In heaven, whatever, you have a finite amount of years, so once you put into a finite experience, so they say, when are you going to die? Ukishemait, however, when you die, moni lola chayim. Then they start assessing how you're going to live forever with God. If you are deserving, and God willing, we will be deserving. Isn't that interesting? Of course, we think just the opposite. When a person's born, he's going to be living. When a person dies, it's all over. Where when he's born, he's going to live a certain finite amount of years. And when he dies, if he's the good person we hope he is, he may live forever with God. I know it's a strange concept. It goes against everything we see. You know, Shlomo Karlbach once said, when we say Shema, we cover our eyes. Right? We cover our eyes. Why do you cover your eyes when you say Shema? You know, when you say there's one God, you can't see God, right? You can't see God. If you're going to say God exists because you see Him, you don't see God. Okay? So you cover your eyes. You don't see God, but yet He is the most true thing. He is the most real thing, much more real than you are. He lives forever. Okay? He's the most real thing there is, and yet you don't see Him. And Rav Karlbach said that the most real things in life you don't see. We think the most real things you see. This table. It's real. I see it. What about love? You don't see that. You don't see it. Kissing isn't love. You don't see love. It's something between two people. You don't see it. and yet it's much more real than this table, which, who knows, some guys put together, it's going to be, you know, thrown away one day. So the most real things in life you do not see. In terms of birth and death, we think you die, it's all over. It's just it's a new beginning. He goes on to say, Nolad Adam Akol Smechin. When a person is born, it's true, everyone's happy. Mei Takol Bochin. When he dies, everyone cries. V'eino Kein. But in a sense, it shouldn't be that way. Ela Nolad Adam Ein Lishmoach Bo. We don't do this. Imagine this. He says, when a person's born, there's not a lot to celebrate yet. What did he do? He didn't do anything. We celebrate the potential, right? Here's a baby, a new life. Right? But he didn't do anything. You don't know. He could be a wicked person in 20 years. You don't know what's going to become of this child. When a person dies, you need to celebrate. If a person died with a good name, and he left this world with a good name, and he left peacefully, then you should celebrate. And that's why it says, in fact, what we just read, that a good name is better than good oil, and greater is the day of death than the day of birth, in terms of celebrating, really knowing what a good name is. Again, none of us do this. When a person dies, we don't go, oh, he had a great name. Yes, Baruch Hashem. Oh, I'm good. We're not glad he died. But in terms of the person's significance, anyway, we usually are very strict on mourning it, you know. You're not allowed to celebrate in terms of normal things. You can't drink wine, you can't eat meat, you can't end the Shiva period, right? All these things you can't do, listen to music, wash for pleasure, all these things. No, that was for before. Then I said, then the Shiva period, you can't do these things. So, generally, we wouldn't have such a view. We celebrate that someone died, but you're not celebrating that. You're celebrating the fact, what a life this person lived, what an incredible person this was. And a baby, it's cute, it's nice, simcha, yes, but again, you don't know what he's or she's going to contribute yet to society. Again, it said here that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of celebration. Okay? How else could that be seen as being the case? How could that be the case? So, if you notice at the end of the verse, it says, V'hachai yitain el libo. The person is better to go to a house of mourning than a house of celebration, because this is the end of man, and a person should put the idea of living into his mind and heart. So there are various explanations. Some say it means that the reason it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of celebration is because you put the living to mind, which means when you go to a house of mourning, you are bringing honor to both the living and the dead. You are bringing honor and comfort to those who survive, the living, and also to the dead, you're showing honor to the one who died. As opposed to you go to a wedding or a celebration, it's generally thought of you just bringing honor to the people who are living, you know, to their celebration, their event, that's fine. But when you go visit someone in mourning, you're bringing kavod to the living and kavod to the dead, both. And that's why there is a greater significance that you can touch the living and the dead and show respect for both in going to the house of mourning.
That's what this stuff is. The idea of, like, when you do a Tara, it's really a chesed shalemet, because you can't get repaid by the person you're doing it for.
Good. That's also a good thing that Barbara is saying, that when you go to a celebration, so you might think, oh, they invited me, wasn't that nice, and I'll invite them back, and I'll get paid back as I went, or whatever, or something good will happen out of this. When you do a Tara and you're on the Chevra Kedisha, which is known as the chesed shalemet, the true act of loving kindness, because when you prepare a body for burial, and you wash the body, so often the people, the mourners, do not know who did it. And furthermore, the dead person, of course, doesn't know. And he's not saying, thank you so much, Rabbi, whoever else is on the team doing the Tara, because thank you so much that you took care of me when I had no one else to take care of. He's not thanking you. He doesn't know. You're not going to be paid back by him. He's not going to now put you in his will if you weren't in it before. You're not going to know. He's not going to know. So that's why this is called the true loving kindness, right? That people would do this. They're not going to get paid back for it. We have a lot of people in our community who do this. It's a very wonderful thing. And a lot of people do it privately. In my first shul in Stamford, there was a woman, and I called her to do a Tara, to prepare a body for burial, and she wasn't home. So the daughter answered, the teenage daughter, and she said, she's not home now. Can I help you, Rabbi? I said, well, I was going to ask your mother to prepare a body this evening, to do a Tara for purification purposes. She said, okay, I'll try to call you. When the mother called me back, she said, Rabbi, I'm not mad at you or anything, but this is something I do very privately. My kids don't know I do this. This is just something like between me and God, you know, that she knew this thing about that you don't get paid back for it. I don't need anyone else to know that I do it. So I didn't really want my kids to even know. It's just something I do. I don't need anyone to know about it. So I didn't realize that to that degree, some people really saw this as such a pure and holy mitzvah that I don't need anyone else to know about it. There are others who give another explanation. They say that when you go to the house of the mourner and you focus upon death, so you will come out, as it says, the hachai yitain elibo. Then you will think about your life. You'll think about you're alive. You're not dead. In fact, this person puts in a very interesting way, Rav Yishai Levi Horowitz, the Shloah HaKadosh. He says, when you go to a house of mourning, and you realize someone has just died, and you realize that you are still alive, this will be taken to your heart. You will do tshuva. You will repent. You will realize, look what I have to do with my life. I should use it more meaningfully, more significantly. I should do good things with my life. I'm not doing enough. When you experience death, it has the ability to do that. You know, all of us sometimes fantasize or think about things or things go through our mind and maybe sometimes even forbidden things. Do you ever notice that you generally don't do that if you're at Weill's funeral home and there's a body right there? You know, that's like, it's more difficult to do when you're right there and you're kind of, it hits you that this person has died and he's right in front of me. Have an impact on you. Of course, if it had the right impact, we'd all change our lives forever as a result. I remember when Rabbi Indit, Shichron Livracha, passed away. Some of you may recall this was during the Gulf War. And we had to bury him on the condition, because he wanted to be buried in Israel, we buried him temporarily, until because you were not allowed to fly at the time in the Mideast. You couldn't fly. So we buried him temporarily with the condition that then we would take him one day and move him back, and move him to Israel where he wanted to be buried. And some of us, myself, Menachem, some of us were involved in reinterring Rabbi Indich, taking his body out. We had actually taken his body out of the casket because he had to be moved to a certain type of casket that could travel from state to state and across lines. We had to take him out and put him into a certain type of casket. And I remember, this was after many months already, and I don't mean this in a negative way, just trying to say what it means when you realize what death is. And there was a stench which comes with when a person's buried, which you never know because you put a body in the ground. This is the only time. And there was a stench which I remember was totally on my clothes. It was like a part of my shoes. It wasn't just like you just wipe it off. It was there for weeks. And I remember that stench, and I tried to say to myself, like, okay, don't forget that smell. Don't forget what death is. Don't, you know, try to apply yourself to every moment you have in life. Don't forget that smell. Really, I said to myself, don't ever forget that smell. Don't forget it. Don't forget it. But I forgot it. And of course, if you don't forget it, how do you go on like being a normal person and laughing again? But I just remember if somehow, you know, you can get a message to yourself, listen, we're only here for a few years, you know, it's not forever. Many of us are fortunate to live long lives, God willing. When you read about that plane crash the other day, and there were young people on it. And we fly those planes all the time, do we not? A regional plane? I mean, there are people who fly them every day, a plane like that. It's a frightening thing. You know, you never know when the end is going to come. And we should put it to our minds, saying here, if the day of mourning and the day of death that you experience with someone else can somehow arouse you to give more meaning to your life, so that's why it's more significant than even the day of the birth of a child or a grandchild. That's what, if we can do that to you, that's where we have this great significance. Yisrael Yitzchak, another, he adds one thing. He says, it's not that the wedding or the mishteh can't be good. It's said that the house of a mourner is better to go there than the house of a celebration and of a wedding. Especially a wedding is the greatest celebration we have in Judaism. So it doesn't say it's not good to go to a wedding. It just says the house of the mourner, you know, can have more of an impact. How can a wedding have an impact? So he suggests that even a wedding, and he brings again the view of the Alshich, even at a wedding you can get the idea of giving more significance to your life and to eternity. Because if you go to a wedding, you understand two people are getting married. And part of the reason is they want to have children. They want to continue what they have throughout the generations. It should keep going, right? It should keep going. It shouldn't stop. So too, therefore, you walk out of a wedding knowing, so I just saw something where two people came together to try to continue eternity on with their children, their grandchildren, and continue in that way. And so too, am I doing everything I can for continuity for my life and for what's going to come after me? So it's not that a wedding can't do that. A wedding also can do that. But let's face it, most people probably don't walk out with that type of vision. They say it was a great time. Wasn't the food great? Wasn't the dancing great? Where out of an experience of mourning, perhaps it can really shake you up, and you can come to do something more.